This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, Pandora's Toolbox, the hopes and hazards of climate intervention. Author Wake Smith.
When science fiction author Kim Stanley Robinson looked into the climate future, real science led him to expect mass heat deaths and then maybe a desperate move to block the sun. It is called geoengineering, where humans try to restore the climate we live in with technology. Not too many people love geoengineering, but a growing chorus of philosophers, scientists, and engineers are weighing out the options. Enter Wake Smith with his coming book, Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. Wake taught a groundbreaking course about geoengineering at Yale. This is the clearest, most accessible book I've ever read on the subject. Wake Smith, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So you were a high-level executive at Boeing Aircraft, then you went into the investment field. How did you end up tackling climate change?
I guess I ran out of desire to be a businessman before I ran out of energy, and so I was eager to do something else with my time and whatever talent I have, and climate strikes me as perhaps the issue of our era, certainly one of the biggies. But I became increasingly clear in my personal study of the climate issue that simply reducing emissions to net zero, as the world is now increasingly rallying behind, is unlikely to be the end of the climate problem. More likely, reaching net zero will merely be the end of the beginning. And so I have become a researcher as a second career into climate interventions of the sort that you mentioned in your intro that may be required primarily after we reach net zero rather than as an alternative method by which to reach net zero. And so I am now a researcher and author and professor in that field.
The book begins with a half dozen chapters explaining our predicament as the planet heats up, and the science you cite is current and it's sound, and regular EcoShock listeners probably have that background direct from the scientists. But you conclude, eventually humans may be desperate enough to try anything?
I wouldn't quite phrase it that way, and I wouldn't be supportive of the climate emergency framing that is in the Kim Stanley Robinson book you mentioned either. This is something that requires a great deal of research and caution and thought as we enter into it. And it may, by the way, be that once we do all that research, we decide it's just a bad idea. That's entirely within the realm of possibility. We haven't done enough science yet to know the answer to that. But it may at least prove that we can't turn the spigot of emissions off fast enough to keep a climate that we would want to live in. And so future generations, in addition to trying to get to net zero, as we in our generation are beginning to do, future generations may also need to repair the climate that has been ruined before they came to it. And they also may need to find ways to be able to thrive in that changed climate while they repair it. And solar geoengineering is a tool by which perhaps future generations might do that last thing, be able to thrive in a too hot world while they try to repair the climate.
Why are you so doubtful about the most natural solutions, for example, planting more trees to help cool the earth?
Well, you can't see it on radio, but I just fell over laughing. It is my goal as a researcher to kill trees. Now, I don't literally mean trees. I hug trees like other people. But killing the idea that trees will solve the climate problem, that I do seek to do, because it's a naive idea that doesn't square with any science. A tree does remove carbon from the atmosphere. That's absolutely true. But the tree falls over in a decade or a century and leaches that carbon back into the atmosphere. So it isn't a permanent store of carbon. The natural fate of forests, by the way, is flame. We, in the modern era, have tried to prevent that But that's what forests naturally do if we leave them there. So we don't even necessarily need to wait for the tree to fall over and die to give its carbon back to the atmosphere. It may do it in a forest fire, which, again, is a perfectly natural bit of the carbon cycle. But the problem we have climatologically is that it's not that we're taking carbon from trees and putting it in the atmosphere and that's creating our problem. It's that we're taking carbon from the deep within the crust of the Earth, carbon that was essentially sequestered there permanently. We're burning that and putting that carbon into the atmosphere. And so we're building up more carbon in the atmosphere than has been natural. And the way to solve that problem is to take carbon out of the atmosphere. That's good. That's what a tree does. But we need to bury that carbon deep in the crust of the earth. A tree doesn't do any of that. And so trees are mostly a very marginal, fragile element of the prospective climate solution. They're not going to get us there. Moreover, trying to plant trees in places where there are no trees today means that we're taking land that is devoted to some other use, such as agriculture, and now trying to make a carbon bank out of that land. There just isn't very much land on the earth that people are going to be eager to do that with. If there's a place where a tree can grow, but there's no tree growing there now, it's because some industrious human cut that tree down to make a farm or a house or a road or some other thing. And so there's also a very severe land constraint that limits the degree to which trees can be a carbon solution. So hug every tree you can find. Good on you. But they are not going to be the solution to the climate problem.
In 2015, we had Dr. David Keith on Radio EcoShock talking about geoengineering. At Harvard, David Keith is a world leader in the field. Wake Smith, what is your relationship with him?
David is a mentor of mine. When trying to get in this field, I discovered a paper of which David was a co-author and essentially went to Harvard and told him that I thought the paper was in error. And his response politely was, gee, if you're so smart, then write a better paper. I'm not sure I wrote a better paper, but I wrote a paper that I think better illuminates that particular issue. And since then, David has been an advisor of mine on much of what I do. So I seek to, you know, collaborate with David on things. But let me be clear, David Keith is the leader of this field, and I don't consider myself in his sort of class. He's been an extraordinary researcher in this field.
Tell us about the direct air capture operation that David has led in Squamish, British Columbia.
I can tell you bits about his operation, but I suppose I would prefer to not so much comment on his company, but comment on direct air capture more generally. I earlier referred to the fact that future generations will likely need to repair a climate that our generation is currently ruining for them. And the primary way to repair a broken climate in the future, or a ruined climate, a too hot climate, will be, as I earlier said, to find ways to remove carbon from the atmosphere and bury it not in the biosphere, as trees would do, but bury it deep in the Earth's crust. But the magnitude of the industry that would be required in the future to capture all of that carbon from the atmosphere and bury it in the Earth's crust, that industry would be roughly the size of the entire fossil fuel industry today. So all the oil, all the gas, all the coal, that's the size industry that we would need to suck carbon out of the atmosphere in the future at the rate that we're currently putting it into the atmosphere today. Well, the fact is we're doing almost none of that carbon capture from direct air in an industrial fashion today. I say almost none because Climate Engineering, the company that David Keith founded, along with a handful of other companies, are in very early stage technology development activities to try to build the sort of direct air capture infrastructure that we would need. But we're decades from being able to scale that technology to the magnitude that would be necessary to really make a dent in the climate problem.
We do learn in your book that the company Canadian Carbon gets millions from Bill Gates and Big Oil, like oil sands financier Murray Edwards. Occidental Petroleum and Chevron sit on the board. That sounds sketchy to the Greens. What is in it for Big Oil?
A couple of things. If the world is going to go in the direction that it needs to go in, which is to move to net zero emissions, the world is going to have to find alternative ways to create the energy that it will need in the future. And oil companies, and for that matter, natural gas and coal companies, they could conceive of themselves merely as those things. They're an oil company and nothing else, in which case the future that we're envisioning is that they're going to go out of business because we've got to stop recovering and burning oil from the Earth's crust. An alternative way that they could conceive themselves is energy companies that provide one form of energy today but may provide some other form of energy tomorrow. And at least if they conceive themselves in that way and if they can make that very difficult transition from being a fossil fuel company to being a wind and solar power company or whatever, that's at least one transition that such companies could imagine undergoing. Yet a different potential motivation, but I should make clear I have no connection with the fossil fuel industry whatsoever, so I don't have any special insight as to what they're thinking, and I certainly don't have any financial dog in this fight. But an alternative vision that I could imagine they have, I think it's precisely why people like Occidental Petroleum are involved in the direct air capture that they're involved in, is that it may be that there is some transitional period of time when we continue to burn fossil fuels because we haven't yet found the next source of energy that can fully replace them, but we try to address the climate problem by capturing the carbon before it's emitted to the atmosphere. And so that's not direct air capture. That would be flue gas capture. But flue gas capture is, in fact, what we need way before we're going to need direct air capture. And so to the extent that fossil fuel companies begin to get into the carbon capture business, that may be a way to continue to provide fossil fuel to the world without heating the world. I don't want to overlook the prospect, though, that some fossil fuel companies may be doing this cynically. Some of them may be doing this for the purpose of greenwashing their reputations. All of that is certainly also a very possible part of the mix of motivations that such companies may have. But make no mistake, the world desperately needs to move forward in terms of its technology and infrastructure by which to capture carbon. And so sort of irrespective of whatever motivations they may have about investing in carbon capture technology, if they are investing in it, that will, even with impure motives perhaps, that will nonetheless be a path forward for that technology, and this is technology that the world will desperately need.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Wake Smith, author of the forthcoming book Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. Pandora's Toolbox covers a huge field and it's in good clear detail, but our radio time is limited, so let's skip ahead to the tool you bring to the table. Wake, you know what it would take to put a fleet of planes up very high and keep them there. Tell us about the climate fix that requires a tireless armada of planes.
Let me do that, but let me first note that the book is equally as much about carbon capture, and it's carbon capture that I'm sure we will need, both from flues and eventually from direct air. I'm candidly less clear that we will need stratospheric aerosol injections, which is what you're referring to, but I'm by no means clear that we won't need that. I worry, in fact, that future generations will demand that. And so we need to develop technologies of all sorts for this problematical climate future, including carbon capture technology, but also probably including ways to deflect out a little bit of the incoming sunlight. And I'm going to repeat that stratospheric aerosol injection is not an alternative to decarbonizing. We still need to decarbonize. The problem, though, is that if it takes us a long time to decarbonize, and I'm afraid it will, I'm an emissions pathway pessimist, it may be that we turn off the emissions spigot way too late and we get the atmosphere way too full of greenhouse gases. And so even though we've now turned off in this future that we're imagining, we've now reached net zero. We've turned off the emissions spigot. We're no longer emitting. The problem is that what informs the climate is not the amount of emissions we do in any given year. It's the cumulative emissions we've ever done since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That's what informs the future climate. So I would think of it as a bathtub. It's not the amount of water coming out of the spigot that informs the climate. It's the level of water in the bathtub. And if we stop filling that bathtub by, say, 2050, as lots of net zero pledges aspire to do, then we would probably, in 2050, still have an acceptable climate. Whereas if it takes us to 2100 or beyond to turn that spigot off, we will have continued to fill the bathtub for all those additional years, and we will end up with a climate that I worry future generations will find to be unacceptable. And if future generations find the climate in their era to be unacceptable, again, they can engage in carbon capture and try to reduce the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, reduce the level of water in our proverbial bathtub. But doing that may take centuries. And so we're talking about having future generations live for centuries in a climate that they will consider to be too hot. And it's not merely that one can turn on an air conditioner and go indoors. There may be whole portions of the earth that have billions of people living in them today that will no longer be capable of supporting agriculture. And so you could have huge impacts on both humans and ecosystems in that too-hot future world. Well, if the world found itself in that too-hot future, it would suddenly demand ways to remediate that situation. And stratospheric aerosol injection, by which the Earth would absorb a little less sunlight, is the most plausible tool that we now know of, despite all of its risks and potential drawbacks. It's nonetheless the most plausible tool that we know of by which a too-hot future could cool the globe.
Discreetly towards the back of the book, with the help of former Boeing engineers, you published designs for aircraft modified to spray sulfur aerosols into the stratosphere. You know those will show up on chemtrails conspiracy websites. Look, here's the plans from Boeing. Proof. The government's spraying us, right? It seems pretty brave to just go in there anyway.
Well, perhaps it is, but I'm at a point in life where I can try to save the world, and if people don't like it, I'm sure they'll tell me that. You suggest that I slip this discreetly in the book. I've published these papers to the whole world before writing the book, so there's nothing discreet about this. But to be clear, I'm not advocating deploying this. I am advocating researching it. And one element of the research, and frankly the research that I can do as a former commercial aviation and aeronautical executive, part of the research that I can do is exactly that sort of research, to try to figure out how the world would actually go about doing this. If we wanted to put this gunk up in the sky, how would we do it? And the world's best paper at the time I came into the field had proposed a variety of different platforms by which you might loft this material into the stratosphere. And so many of my papers have tried to get much more specific about that. Is it guns or rockets or balloons or airplanes or other means by which we would get the stuff in the sky? And the likely answer is it's airplanes. how big an airplane, what would its characteristics be, where would it need to fly, how many of them would you need, and therefore what would the cost of all of this be. That's the thrust of my most meaningful research, and it does seek to make more comprehensible what this sort of intervention would look like. And making it more comprehensible, more concrete, helps narrow the region of darkness on a lot of the questions that concern people about this. Could it be done covertly by some billionaire off of his island in the Pacific? Well, the answer, as soon as I come to it and illuminate how big an intervention this would be, the answer to that is no. This is a huge enterprise that would be immediately detectable by the outside world if anybody attempted to do it. And so getting rid of that concern that, you know, some person or country could do this covertly, as the chemtrailers imagine, as soon as you do some math, it becomes quite clear that that's silly. But the fact that we illuminate what this might look like doesn't sweep all of the problems about it off of the table. It just means we can worry about potentially real problems rather than potentially silly problems.
Making it personal, you asked your bright 21-year-old Yale students, what are they willing to give up to make the climate future safer? And they said?
They essentially shrugged. It's as if the question hadn't occurred to them previously. And to be clear, these are climate-concerned college juniors who competed to get into this seminar, so this wasn't a thoughtless group of students. But what it illuminated to me was that not even very climate-concerned people believe that solving the climate problem will require personal sacrifice from them. People imagine that it's big bad Boeing, big bad Exxon or big bad General Motors that is creating the problem, and that we need to go berate those parties and tax them and, you know, demand changes from them. But if you say to people, well, where did you go over Christmas and did you fly there? The answer is generally yes, or if they didn't fly there, it's because it wasn't very far away. But people aren't yet, by and large, making personal sacrifices to solve the climate problem. People are not in favor of things like carbon taxes, which would require some personal sacrifice. And P.S., I don't love taxes any more than anybody else does. But I'm afraid what that episode illustrated to me is that the world doesn't really understand what solving the climate problem will require. It will require personal sacrifice. It will require paying something for something that is now free. And that something is the ability to drive your car down the road and vent your CO2 out the tailpipe into the atmosphere. That venting of CO2 from your tailpipe has a cost for future generations, but we today aren't paying that cost. And as soon as we ask each other to pay that cost, people will push back. And it's not crazy that they do push back. I'm not criticizing that exactly. But the sort of radical changes to lifestyles that would be necessary to quickly decarbonize turn out to bring unwanted consequences to the present that people aren't voting for. And so you're quite right. That class at Yale demonstrated to me the distance that all of us need to travel and have not yet traveled mentally to understand what solving the climate problem will really mean from the standpoint of personal sacrifices that we will all need to make.
How far along is stratospheric aerosol injection research and testing of it?
Nowhere. I'm literally one of the guys in the world farthest along in it, and I'm a rookie. So we're nowhere near being capable of doing this. It is still, the amount of field experiments that have been done is exactly zero. It's all still in, not even in the lab. It's research papers being done in universities, but we've done no field testing whatever. And that's one of the many reasons why we're not right around the corner from implementing this. And once again, doing field tests may demonstrate that it's a bad idea. I hope that it doesn't demonstrate that, because if I'm right about where we're headed climatologically, people in the future are going to need solutions to the climate problem that we are exporting to them. And if stratospheric aerosol injection turns out not to be a viable solution, that takes away one of the best potential tools in Pandora's toolbox from the future. And so the future is going to have to find other tools.
Well, the book is brave, and I may lose a few listeners just for doing this show, but maybe geoengineering is like nuclear bomb technology. We should not talk publicly about what we've got and how it is done. Why are you going public?
Oh, I see that as very wrong-headed thinking. People often analogize to nuclear technology when thinking about geoengineering. It's just way different than that. There's no plausible way, and I'm writing a paper on this right now, to weaponize this. This is an unexcludable global intervention, and so it's not something I can do to you and not do to me. So it's not targetable in that sense. It's not clear that it's weaponizable. It can't be done secretly, as I've earlier mentioned. The whole world would know about anybody doing it. The most problematical elements of this are the governance. Who would be in charge? Whose hand would be turning the global thermostat, and how much would it turn it? And the only good solutions in respect of those governance questions lie in openness and transparency. I don't think this is dangerous breakout technology that we need to prevent the world from getting. And neither do I think this should be developed covertly. This is university-type territory, not CIA-type territory. If we're doing this at all, we're doing this as a merciful intervention that the future demands. I don't feel any need to hide an effort to mercifully alleviate the suffering of future generations.
We have been speaking with Wake Smith. He is the former aviation executive turned investor, now dedicating himself to one question: what can we do about global warming? Coming out in March, Wake's new book is Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. It is like taking a Yale course on the subject, but more entertaining. Wake, thank you for spending the time with our listeners.
Very kind of you to have me.